pipeline incidents in Canada?
Yes.
Hi, is the recorder going?
Okay. I think maybe, it's here. Oh, this visualization was made, I think I mentioned to some people already. The idea was to make data public. So everybody interested to check if there was an old pipeline passing through its farm or his or her farm or on the neighborhood. And so, and the idea was to show all this. You see, these are all pipeline related. For example, in this province, in Saskatchewan, there was different types of incidents, like release of substance, types of operation, fire, whatever. And then the idea is that you can move this inside, and you see which phase of the pipeline happens. It happens if it was during the operation, the construction, when was released, the volume that was released, if it's applicable, and you can move back. And there is some explanations also. What happens in the case. And then you can go, you can, also you have a map where you can see the small ones, more detailed. In the position. A specific incident, for example, and here, and then you can mark it on the side, and you can compare two of them and see what happens. You see all the narrative of the incident. It's a kind of complex, but that's it. And the other issue I can say about that is how it was designed. So I first sketched it by hand, and then I tried to find some tools where I can mount it without using code. And I use raw graphs. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And I try to use real data in parts, relating it just to be able to construct it. And then it was approved. And then after that, it was coded.
Ah, OK. So raw graphs is a kind of proof of concept step.
Yeah, but I was able to do in raw only small part, like, for example, real for incident type. And then I save it and move it to Illustrator, and then join the other part, and then it was really manual.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. So session six, mapping and information design usability.
So I think this is going to go over 10 minutes, but hopefully not too egregiously. I think this is going to be a little bit more abstract than the title suggests, but it will get more concrete as I keep going. So let's see how it goes. I was really inspired by an art exhibit that I saw a few years ago, Kader Atiyah, The Culture of Fear. I saw it at the Contemporary Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney, and it's essentially a giant room with very, very tall metal bookshelves with periodicals, as well as some books from the French press about violence against colonial and post-colonial subjects. And I think they even have some Journal des Voyages in here. It's a very moving and kind of scary space to be in. And this really drove my questions yesterday about the images are very important here. But it's also a reminder of how from the kind of very first moments when you think about how to work with this material, how to take into account the you know, the emotional, the affective experience of reading and processing and thinking about the text and the images, and what that means when we start to do things with it as scholars. And so I just, this is a kind of what's in the back of my mind as I thought through what I wanted to say today. So I was doing some reading. The last couple of years have been really interesting in thinking about sort of the politics of mapping. And some of you may have seen Vincent Brown's project on mapping a slave revolt. He and some of his collaborators and critics have a nice roundtable in Social Text from 2015, where he says, with movement, interaction, and transformation, patterns are made and remade in this visualization website that they made. By tracing these patterns, historical analysts can develop a visual language that may recover and illustrate spatial practices and processes. This is a thematic historical cartography seen less as a techno-scientific form of observation from above by the colonizer than as a rhetorical practice that can define, clarify, and advocate visions of the world that might otherwise go unarticulated. And I think particularly this last part is something to keep in mind. This is just a screenshot of the website that they made, which includes a series of historical maps. You can choose your layer. And a narrative on the left of a kind of the slave revolt that he's telling a history of. You can see time moving across on the bottom. And then you have these large, very wide kind of lines indicating motion and action on the map, both by insurgents, slaves, and a colonial military and settler groups.
Excuse me, where is this place?
Where this is, gosh, I forget right
it's
now.
Funny,
is it
that's
Jamaica?
The first thing I said. I was like, the first thing is there's missing information about where this is even.
Yeah,
this is, I should know this, I'm sorry.
Where, Elena? Ballard Valley?
Isn't it Jamaica, I think?
It's interesting that it doesn't show.
I have the website in a slide, sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, all right. So to pick up on Brown's point, I think we can ask in this project, how can a digital representation of the Journal des Voyages surface what might otherwise go unarticulated? So for Brown, the what's unarticulated in the text accounts that were written in the 18th century were the kind of the actions of the slaves themselves and how the movement of these, the kind of coordinated movement of the rebellion operated spatially in relation to white actions in the landscape, and it kind of puts front and center the actions of the insurgents for the historical viewer, and it kind of puts us in that historical landscape through the use of the historical maps. So what in the Journal des Voyages can kind of operate the same way? So some ideas. Is looking at geographical coverage over time, as this changes over time, a way to get at something that is certainly not explicitly stated in the text, but is a kind of pedagogy of understanding the world for readers as they read issue to issue to issue. What's the distribution and the gaps in this geographical coverage, right? What is the unsaid? What are the relationships, we talked about this yesterday, from place to place, between places and people, individuals, groups, organizations? What is the kind of rhetoric about certain entities, right? So what are the discourses that are used about people and about places? What is the geography of the images, right? So what are they represented? Can you locate those places? Should they be located, right? Is it impossible to locate them because they're kind of generic abstractions of colonial imagery? Or are they meant to be representations of actual locations on the earth? How much of that is explicit in the text? And then finally, I was really interested in, within the journal itself, what is represented cartographically? And what do those choices about what gets mapped reflect about the journal that is not talked about in the journal? And so just some examples for us to kind of have a look at. There's contests where you're supposed to name what this bay is and name the cities along this bay, right? So this is kind of pedagogical use of maps. And then two more examples. I just in flipping through some issues, discovered that almost every issue in this 19th century set of issues has a history of a department in France, right? So here's the Sarthe. You have a map with roads, and it tells you what the neighboring departments are. And this sits squarely within a description of other parts of the world. But as Chris has indicated, that a lot of the content is actually about France itself. And they're mapping that. Then they also have just these big general maps, the Americas. There were some other examples like this. But with not, explicit information about French imperial holdings necessarily. But I was surprised actually by how few maps there really are in relation to images of bodies, things like this. Okay, second kind of thinking point is one of the other roundtable pieces from the same issue. This is one of the designers for the Brown Project. And Dylan says, we should not simply turn to the colonial archive to excavate the hidden documents of the past, but should do so to understand how the production, circulation, and housing of documents themselves are part and parcel of a colonial technology of rule, part and parcel of how colonialism thinks and constructs the world. To redesign the archive, to imagine new forms with which to engage the archive, is thus to disrupt and throw into relief the coloniality of knowledge and history itself. So the Journal des Voyages is not an archive. There's my 10 minutes. This is a disaster. it's not an archive. But we can take this thinking about technologies of rule to understand how the journal is constructed at, within a colonial culture, and whether it's possible to then uncover resistance, stories of resistance or counter geographies. So again, some points to think about here. How does the geography of the journal map onto modern geopolitical entities? So instead of seeing modern borders as the problem always, what can they help us see about that historical content? And what is the relationship between discussion of those places in the past and nation states today? Again, what are the places that are not in the journal? What is colonial in the journal? Is it the French Empire? Is it the British Empire? Is it other empires? What is the kind of rhetoric of colonialism? Is this actually a periodical about the empire? Is this a technology of empire? What does representation of the empire mean on these pages? And then I think finally, this is a really important question, how does the journal establish its authoritativeness, right? So we have this nice stamp of approval for use in the by the Ministry of Education and schools. What other ways does the journal present itself as an authoritative rendering about information, geographical information in the world? Is that the kinds of people who contribute articles? Is it about the geographical scope and how that changes over time? What are the elements of the production and design of the periodical itself that communicate and establish authority for its readers? And you know, are there readers for whom that authority doesn't register, right? So what's the flip side of accepting the authority of the journal? Are there ways that certain communities respond to the journal that are unintended by its creators? Is there a way of getting at that? Okay, finally, Jessica Marie Johnson has a fairly new piece, also in Social Text. Apparently, this is a great place to do critical work on DH. I'm gonna send in a paper. Markup Bodies, really amazing article. And this is just a tiny snippet of some brilliant writing. She says, the digital, like any tool, institution, or system across society, from law and medicine to the academy, will be radical or transformative only to the extent that researchers, programmers, designers, hackers, and users make an effort to dismantle the residue of commodification that is slavery's legacy in the new world, which leads to a question, how can spatial representation delegitimize colonial violence and offer, as Johnson suggests, a really important contribution to the history of the present as well. And so this really resonated with me after I had read your materials, and it seemed right up the same alley. And so this is where we get kind of more concretely into the challenges of doing this kind of spatial representation of information that's created by and for a colonial audience. So discrete data is what we usually create when we do things like named entity recognition, and how we choose to represent that geospatially has a whole set of problematics. I'm gonna bracket that for the next slide for the moment. But it's also interesting to think about, is there continuous data that you want to represent? Things that are not points, lines, and smaller polygons, but things that might be represented as raster data, for example. Is that something that you can see in the text that normally gets ignored, right? Is there something unarticulated that can be represented as continuous data? Really exciting work happening now on representing motion. I think Brown's project gets at this. A lot of the work, early work in the Spatial History Project at Stanford was about motion. But now moving towards thinking about the relationships between entities and how you can think about modeling spatial information not based on geospatial location, but on relative locations contained by, next to, north of, things like that. So QSR is qualitative spatial relations, new field, and it really gets at moving beyond a kind of discrete point oriented representation of information. Base maps are a huge problem. Brown opts for some historical scanned maps. We've all seen projects that use modern maps to as a base map for historical data. And so states and nation boundaries pop up when those don't actually exist for the period of the data set. Gazetteers are a really inherently problematic source of information for historical projects because the kind of original information that gazetteers come from when they began as print materials was often from colonial nation states trying to document and impose their way of naming places around the world. Projection, it's already come up. Symbology, I won't get too much into that. But I really am very interested in absence and how we represent absence. There's a lot that is not in the Journal des Voyages. And I think that the maps that you've created really represent presence of information. But what are the parts of the empire that are not getting talked about? And how can you also document that with something that's not just empty space, right? Is there something useful about that kind of representation? And then finally, and I think this comes back to the Atiya exhibit, the bookshelves is context. It's all well and good to represent information from a single data set, but we learn so much more when we put one data set into conversation with another data set. And that if you look at the 19th century periodical press about colonial violence and you put that into a conversation with 20th century French publications, you see a different story, right? And so is there something about the kind of long-term life of this project where you're able to do something really powerful that contributes to a history of the present, about the effects of colonialism in the parts of the world that the journal is talking about, by putting it into conversation with other data sets. And we talked a little bit about that yesterday in, you know, thinking about what access to domestic newspapers might offer and things like that. So here's Jamaica, thank you. Here's the link to the Brown project. And I just put up some examples. I'm gonna show some screenshots to a few of them. The first, Corpus Synodalium, is a project that I consulted on last year with a medieval historian, Rowan Doran, and his students. And it's a project that has a text corpus. He wants to map some data. I'll show that. Palestine Open Maps is a really awesome project that is being run brilliantly by someone who is an MA student right now. He's running this whole project. It uses OpenStreetMap as a base map layer. He's scanning historical maps of Palestine and basically tracking the destruction and reconstruction by various groups in the Palestinian land. Litmong is a kind of guided narrative trip through Edinburgh literary history, which has been a kind of used as an example for doing that kind of work. Slave Revolt in Jamaica. The HGIS de las Indias is a really important example of a historical gazetteer created from period materials in the language. Van der Stangel made this gazetteer. It was a labor of love. And I think it's a kind of model for historical gazetteer construction in the kind of greater former colonial world. And then finally, philologic is a platform that a lot of French historians are familiar with, because when we go search for the Encyclopédie or a database called Frantext, or now the French Revolution speech corpus, philologic is the software that allows you to search through the text. So I'll show you that, because this is also what Corpus Synodalium is built in. Really quickly, points and polygons I have very strong feelings about. Points are very, very specific. And we've talked a little bit about what it means to use points to represent people. We're very used to points representing places. But it's crucial to kind of ask yourself, what is it that this point represents? Is this really a point, right? Who decided that this should be a point? And what is the fact that I'm able, if I'm using this point as a pin on a map, what kind of generates the information about where that point goes, right? So this comes back to the issue of gazetteers being potentially highly problematic for resolving a place name in a text to a location on the earth for a colonial place. All right, so I'll give an example of a kind of something that made me question the use of points in a GUI, and that was our early GUI for viewing NER results for the Encyclopédie. Polygons, I want to point to a publication by a colleague, Lucas Schultz, really excellent article on why using polygons for early modern kind of spatial analysis is hugely problematic, really kind of fitting into the history of borders, something that simply don't exist, either materially or intellectually in the early modern world, and certainly not before the early modern world, as they do today, and then therefore the kind of use of polygons to represent spatial entities in a GIS setting is highly problematic. So there's a lot of projects, including Corpus Synodalium, the French Book Trade project that I mentioned, lots of others that spend a lot of time making customized polygons of nation states in their period of study, hundreds, thousands of hours. What is the real payoff there? So I just want to kind of put a caveat out there that time spent vectorizing historical data is not always time well spent. Okay, so some examples. This is the GUI I mentioned for viewing our NER results. Basically, there was some ways to kind of filter them. We see each encyclopedie headword in our gold standard. So the only one that starts with A is Asmer. We can see the text of the article here. Asmer is Ville des Andes dans les États de Mogol, capitale de la province de Sémenon. So Asmer is a city in the Indies, in the states of Mogol, capital of the province of the same name, and it exists in it exists in DBpedia with a different spelling, which we pick up, and that assigns a latitude and longitude, and you can see this pin down here. This is probably a less problematic example, but you know, what does it mean when you have an article that is contesting the location of this place? So much of the Encyclopédie geography corpus is about how a place might be in four places. Somebody said it was here, but this other person said it was over here, and now we've done some archaeological work and we think it might be in this third location. So if we're geolocating the headword of an Encyclopédia article, where does the pin go? Is it one place?
multiple.
It's multiple, right? So this is the kind of problem we have, and I imagine there's a lot of uncertainty about where some places are in the 19th century corpus. And so the idea that